The lesson I want to present this morning may not at first seem to have very much to do with the passage that I asked Joshua to read prior to our lesson. I want to tell you a story from the Old Testament, story of a fellow by the name of Absalom. Most everybody remembers Absalom, even as little kids, if nothing else. You know, we remember the fellow that got his head stuck in the tree and all of that big head of hair that he had. In fact, I always imagine him hanging by the hair from the tree, although I really kind of doubt that was quite the way it took place. But Absalom's life was tied up in a horrible series of family tragedies, disasters that occurred within the household of King David. You'll recall that in 2 Samuel chapter 12 especially, we read the account, actually in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12, we read the account of David's adultery with Bathsheba and how after the death of Uriah, Nathan comes and is in fact sent by the Lord to confront David with his sin. And in the aftermath of all of that, we began to read about some of the things that happened subsequently in the family of King David. And I want to focus especially on this character of Absalom. Starting in 2 Samuel chapter 13, I'd like to spend some time just telling the story of Absalom and what happened to him. It says, it was after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. The wording might seem at first a little unusual right there, that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. But we have to remember that in this polygamous situation, David had a number of wives. And in this family, Absalom and his sister Tamar were full brother and sister, children of the same wife. Amnon, on the other hand, was son of another of David's wives, and yet he had fallen in love with what we might say his half-sister, Tamar, here. And we're told that he was so frustrated because of his sister Tamar that he made himself ill, for she was a virgin, and it seemed hard to Amnon to do anything to her. She, in her virginal purity and presumably an attractive young lady, was just the subject of his obsession, it seems. And he couldn't figure out what to do about it. And yet he had a friend whose name was Jonadab. Jonadab, we're told in verse 3, was a very shrewd man. Shrewd, might connote to us some positive quality, and indeed I suppose shrewdness can be used in a positive way. But we will soon find out that this is the type of fellow that often inhabits the circles of power and who knows how to manipulate people and get things done, regardless of the consequences or the morality of the circumstances. And so he says to Amnon, what's the matter? And Amnon tells him, I'm in love with my sister Tamar, with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom. Well, they keep talking about not my sister, but the sister of my brother Absalom. And so Jonadab said, well, look, here's what you can do. He says, you just pretend that you are sick. And then when the king comes in to see you, you tell him, nothing will make me feel better but to have Tamar come and prepare some food for me. And sure enough, it works. In verse 7, it says, David sent to the house for Tamar, saying, go now to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was lying down, and she took the dough and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes and so on. And he sends everybody out. And in verse 10, he says, bring the food in the bedroom that I made from your hand. So Tamar took the cakes which she'd made, and she came, and she brought them, and he grabbed her. And in the latter part of verse 11, he says, come lie with me, my sister. Now he finally calls her his sister, which was also a term of endearment in the ancient world. But she answered him, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing." Verse 14, it says, however, he would not listen to her, and since he was stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. He raped her. Then Amnon hated her. She is no longer in his eyes the pure virgin. He hated her with a great hatred, for the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he loved her. And of course, none of these are true love. This is an obsession that is now replaced by revulsion. And it's often the case that when we know that we have done something wrong, we lash out at others. And so here, his hatred of her is perhaps a displaced hatred of himself. And he sends her out. And she says, "Oh no, you're not going to do this. You're not going to just kick me out." But he does. And in verse 18, says she had on a long sleeve garment. For in this manner the virgin daughters of the king dress themselves in robes. And she goes out, and in verse 19, she puts ashes on her hair and head on her head and tears this long sleeve garment. And she goes away weeping and crying. And in verse 20, Absalom, our man, appears. And he said to her, "Has Amnon your brother been with you?" Apparently, word had gotten out or was understood what had happened. And he says, "But now keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart." I'm not sure exactly how he meant for her to take that, but he took her in, took care of her, and made sure that she was provided for. And we find out pretty soon that he was determined he was going to get revenge, that he was going to avenge this defiling of his sister. It says, when King David heard of all of these matters, he was very angry. And we can well imagine that that would be the case. But it does not appear that David actually did anything, that he made any procedure to punish Amnon for the violation of his sister, or did anything else about all of this. Verse 22, but Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. And you don't have any trouble relating to that. In fact, I think, you know, our sympathies pretty generally lie with Absalom right here. But he bides his time. He is waiting the opportunity to do something about this. And 2 years later, he arranges such an opportunity. Verse 23, it came about after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons, whole royal family. I presume this is some type of festival. I mean, we really don't know all the details about this, and I don't suppose any of us have ever been to a sheep shearing festival, but apparently it's some such thing as this that he has arranged. And he sends up and says, you know, let the whole royal family come down. And he wants the king to come too, David. But David declines. And verse 25, the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, we should not all go, lest we be burdensome to you." Although he urged him, he would not go, but blessed him. And I don't know for sure, but I suspect that Absalom knew David wasn't going to come. Because what he was really after was not to get David to come down there. He wanted Amnon to come. And Amnon, as it turns out, and as far as we can tell, was actually the oldest son within the family. We do read much earlier about an older son, Chileab, who was actually David's firstborn, and Amnon his secondborn. But we only read about Chileab very early on, and I suspect it is very likely that as mortality rates were rather high in the ancient world, that Chileab was for some time dead now. Amnon is the heir apparent to the throne. He's sort of like the junior king here as the king's oldest son. And so if the king can't go, you know, if the president can't go, he sends the vice president to stand in his role. And somewhat like that with the crown prince or the oldest son of the king. So in verse 26, Absalom says, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But when Absalom urged him, he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Perhaps after these 2 years, David kind of decides, well, maybe Absalom's not going to do anything about this, and maybe a little suspicious or a little concerned, but anyway, he lets him go. And in verse 28, Absalom commanded his servants, saying, "See now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then put him to death, do not fear. Have I not, I myself, commanded you, be courageous and be valiant?" And the whole thing was a setup. And so they come down, they have their festival or whatever it is they're doing there. And in the process, Amnon gets killed. He's assassinated. He's murdered. But it is a revenge for the rape of Absalom's sister. And of course, pandemonium breaks out after that. All the king's sons arose and each mounted his mule and fled. Mules were kind of royal steeds. We don't think of them that way, but that was apparently even better than a horse for a king. And all this chaos breaks out. And the first word that gets back to David is that Absalom has killed the whole family. All of his sons. And he arose and tore his clothes and lay on the ground, and all of his servants were standing by and clothes torn. But in verse 32, Jonadab, that's interesting. He's the fellow that had put Amnon up to all this to begin with, but now he seems to be on the inside of what's going on with Absalom and taking revenge on Amnon. Jonadab, the son of Shimea, David's brother, responded, and he says, "Don't worry." He says, it's just Amnon. You know, Absalom was really mad at him. He says, this was bound to happen. Says, this is intent of Absalom has been determined since the day he violated his sister Tamar. So he says, "Do not let my lord the king take report to heart, namely all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead." And Jonadab said to the king, "Behold, the king's sons have come." You know, and so it discovers that some. Okay, only one that's been killed is Amnon, and, you know, this was one of those things that were just bound to boil over someday. What did Absalom do? Verse 34 says, "Now Absalom had fled." I mean, on the one hand, it's awfully easy to understand what Absalom has done. He has avenged the rape of his sister. On the other hand, he's also committed murder. He's killed the crown prince. And this fellow Jonadab, I'm really suspicious of. But still, Absalom heads off into a sort of a self-imposed exile. And in verse 37 says, "Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amminahud, the king of Geshur, up to the north of David's kingdom. And David mourned for his son every day." It's a little ambiguous, but I think he's talking about mourning for Amnon, the one that has been killed. So Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there for 3 years. But with the passing of time, David's mourning for Amnon turns to a mourning for Absalom. Because, after all, David himself would understand the motivations, and yet he can't, motivations of Absalom, and yet he can't really just excuse this murder that has taken place either. And so he's in this dilemma where he really doesn't have any clue, apparently, how to handle the situation. And he lets his son Absalom stay in exile, and yet he doesn't try to go get him to punish him. And we're told that he begins to long for this son of his. And Joab was David's military commander, been with him for many years. Joab, son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom, that he's longing for this alienated son. And so he sent down the little village of Tekoa, that's where later the prophet Amos would come from, kind of an obscure village out on the fringe of the wilderness. And there was a woman there with a reputation as a wise woman. He has her brought up. And he says, "Now you go in to King David and you tell him this little story here." kind of like Nathan earlier had told him the little story about the rich man who's taken the lamb from his neighbor. And so she goes in and she tells this story, how she had these two sons and they had a falling out, and one of them killed the other one. And now her relatives were saying that they ought to put the surviving son to death for killing his brother. And she says, that's going to leave me, a widow, with neither husband nor children. And she pleads with King David to intervene on her behalf. And she says, verse 7, now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant. And they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. Thus they will extinguish my coal which is left, and so leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. And the exact details of what is said in the follow-up, not sure I understand all of, but the gist of it is, at first King David kind of seems to put her off, but then she is more insistent, and insists in fact that he take an oath to protect her. And in verse 11 she says, please let the king remember the Lord your God. That's an expression for taking an oath, in the name of God to take an oath, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord lives, he does it, he remembers the name of the Lord, as the Lord lives, not a hair of your son shall fall to the ground. And so she gets him, she tells him this little story about her two sons, and as far as we know, this story didn't really happen. This is just like the story Nathan told him. It turns out to be just a little parable, which is eventually made known to David. And when he finally says, okay, I'll intervene on your behalf. I will make it so they don't kill the one surviving son you have, to punish him because he got in a fight with his brother and killed him. And at that point, she says in verse 12, now I've got something to say to you. She says, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord the king. And he said, speak. And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? And I suspect at first I said, what in the world? What are you talking about? Plan something against the people of God? She continues, for in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring back his banished one. She says to him, look, what I've told you is just a parable here, an analogy. You're the one who has two sons, and one of them killed the other. And now people are saying you ought to punish the one that killed the other, and he's gone into exile, and you're stuck. You know, and you can't figure out what to do. And you let him stay in exile. You know, why don't you do something about it? You're grieving yourself. You're destroying the country here. You're the one that's really in this situation. And then in verse 14, I want you to look especially at that verse. You understand why they call this woman a wise woman. She says, for we shall surely die, and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away life, but plans ways so that the banished one may not be cast out from him. To me, this is an amazing thing that this woman says. This is hardly the place in the Bible that you expect to see the whole scheme of redemption summed up. And yet I think that's exactly what this woman does. She says to David, look, I mean, you know what a human life is like? It's fragile. And we live it and it's done it, and you can't undo it. Things that are done, you can't go back and redo. She says, We're going to die, and we're like water spilled on the ground, and when we're dead, you can't pull things back together. Whatever's done is done. She says, but God does not take away life, but plans ways so that the banished one may not be cast out from it. Now, I'm going to take this story of David, like she takes her story of her two sons and applies it to David. And surely there were some things in which her story didn't compare exactly with David's story. And yet there was a fundamental similarity. I want to take David's story and Absalom's story and make a parable out of that and compare it to God and his children. And yeah, there are a lot of ways in which they don't compare. David's a very poor analogy in some ways to God. David, in some ways, I think, had probably brought much of this disaster within his family on himself by his own conduct. And certainly, the probably generally public knowledge of what had happened with him and Bathsheba didn't provide a very good environment for his sons growing up and their attitude towards things such as might have caused Amnon to do what he did and many other things as well. Yeah, I understand that. But this is not a perfect analogy. And yet, David is a man after God's own heart who's king over the kingdom of God. There's some basis for making the connection. But most especially, I want you to think about God, the creator of Adam, and Adam and Eve there in the Garden of Eden. God had told Adam and Eve, after having placed them there in that garden, that they were not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he had said, in the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Now that causes a lot of people a problem. They say, now wait a minute. They ate, but they didn't die. They were cast out of the garden. And in fact, Adam lived for 900 years plus. So I think what happens a lot of times we go back and say, well, when God said in the day you eat thereof, you will surely die, we say, well, he was only speaking about spiritual death back there. He wasn't talking about, he didn't mean to say that Adam was going to physically die. But I think in that, we probably miss one. I'm sure that God was talking about spiritual death, but I don't think he was talking about only spiritual death. I think he was talking about physical death too. You say, but Adam didn't die. Yeah, that's right. God is not only gracious, but God is also, or God is not only just, but he's also gracious, and he's also merciful. Adam was worthy of death. I think he probably became mortal at that point. But he was worthy to die, he and Eve both, right at that point. But what did God do? Did he kill them? Would he have been justified in doing so? Well, he killed Ananias and Sapphira when they lied. He surely would have been justified in killing Adam and Eve. But like this wise woman understands, God does not take away life. He does not desire to see the death even of sons that have sinned and rebelled against him. And so, he allows Adam and Eve to continue to live. But they are cast out of the garden. They are, as Absalom was, banished. They have to go into a sort of an exile in which they are alienated from their father, separated from him. And yet the heart of God longs, even for those rebellious children, to be able to come and be in fellowship with him again. As the wise woman said, God does not take away life, but he plans ways so that the banished one may not be cast out from him. And just as Joab intervened and got this woman to get David to plan a way so that his banished son might be brought back to him. So the whole Bible, really, is the story of God devising a means so that we, as his rebellious children, sinful children, worthy of death, might be restored to him. So that we, as banished children, might be brought back into fellowship with the Father. And that's the story of the Bible, how God would send His Son to die on the cross that we might be forgiven of our sins and as banished children brought back into fellowship with God. The analogy, of course, is only partial, but David proceeds to devise a means wherein Absalom can return. And indeed, he does come back. You know, it looks like this fellow Absalom might really be a pretty good fellow. In verse 27 here in chapter 14, we're told that, you know, he was this handsome fellow. He has three sons. He has one daughter. And you know what he names his daughter? To me, this is a touching point. He names his daughter Tamar, in memory, obviously, of his violated sister. And he lives 2 years in Jerusalem. And at first, he's not fully restored to his father. But then he protests and finally is brought back into full relationship with his father, David. And we might think the story would end right there. You might think the sermon would end right there, and it's going to end real quick. But there's one more thing. In some ways, everything that we've said up to this point is kind of introduction. God does not take away life, but He devises means that His banished one may not depart from Him. Well, here David's done that. He has been like God. Probably a lot of losing face on David's part over this. Probably a lot of people, maybe some understood Absalom, but on the other hand, there were probably plenty that didn't think too much of what David had done either. Just, you know, if it's the king's son, if it hadn't been anybody else, he wouldn't have gotten away with that. But David bore the shame and the embarrassment and the self-effacement and brought about the restoration of his son. You would think that at the very least, Absalom would appreciate what had been done for him. That his father had devised a means that he might be restored. Maybe with all that family dynamics, it was such that Absalom would never be able to love and respect his father. I don't know. That's looking at that just from the human aspect. But you would certainly think that he would at least respect and honor what his father had done. But in the next couple of chapters, a whole nother story unfolds. Not Absalom, the avenger of his violated sister, but Absalom, the son who is determined to kill his father and take his throne. And here, after all of the things that have been brought about to effect his reconciliation, he turns against the father who had reconciled him. And begins the rebellion. We won't go through all the story of that, but rebels against his father, seeks to kill his father, eventually pursues his father with the army. And were it not for, apparently, the military acumen of Joab and those that remained loyal to David, probably would have succeeded in killing his father. In fact, cast a pall over everything, because suddenly you go back and reread that whole business about him killing Amnon to avenge his sister Tamar. And yeah, I expect he did, but boy, it sure was convenient that he killed the oldest surviving son in the family and left himself as the next oldest son in the family. Kind of suspicious there. And he goes and is going to hunt his father down like a dog and kill him. As I say, were it not for the military strength of Joab and those that remained loyal to David, very likely would have succeeded. But it didn't succeed. He gets caught in the tree in the battle and eventually is killed. But I want you to come back to David. David was not at the battle. He was waiting back at the city nearby. And word comes back, and of course he had given orders not to kill that son of his. And when the word comes back that they've won, his first question is, what happened to Absalom? He still loved that rebellious son. And to me, that makes the tragedy all the greater. That here this father who loved that rebellious son so much had done the best he could to bring about reconciliation, yet the son still turned against him, even after being reconciled. And the final picture, when he hears of Absalom's death, is that he goes up and he says, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." The love and the grief are as deep as they can be. Again, I have to say repeatedly, there are many ways in which this does not compare with what God has done for us. But there are some fundamental ways in which it seems to me that it does. You see, the persistent love of a father, even for a rebellious son, and how much more awful that makes the rebellion appear. That even after what he did to reconcile his banished son, his son still turns and rebels against him. And I think we ought to take to heart how much the Father loved us. David said he wished he could die. God did, in the place of his son, to reconcile his banished children, that they might not die. God devises means that his banished one might return. And so he did. How horrible do you see Absalom being once his real motivation comes out and we see him rebelling against the father that had restored him. And Absalom, he starts out somebody that you could almost admire for, you know, standing up for his violated sister. He ends up one of the most depraved characters in all the Bible. How do we appear when we have a father who loved us so much that he did die in the person of his son, that he might redeem and reconcile us to him? And yet we turn and rebel against him again. We're going to stand and sing in just a moment a song of invitation. It may be that there's someone present this morning who has a need of obeying the gospel. It's been taught what they need to do to become a child of God. Or it may be that there's some rebellious son that needs to be reconciled to a father who loves him and who would and did die for him. Don't be an Absalom. Be a faithful son to a father who loves you so much. If you're subject to the invitation, we extend it now as we stand and sing together.